The following podcast is from the weekly message at Summit Church in Upstate South Carolina. More information is available at summitupstate.org.
Have you ever started a story and you think how you know the story ends? Or what kind of story you're getting into, and then you get about one page into it, and you're like, this isn't the story that I thought I was going to be reading. I don't know what to do with this now. I took my kids, I was going to be a good dad over spring break, and I took my kids to Cedar's Head, and we were going to do the hiking thing. We're going to be out in the wilderness, and I thought that was going to be the very memorable experience that I was going to have with my kids, hiking around Cedar's Head, and so we do the hike around, and we do the picnic up on the mountaintop, and you just see forever, and all my kids survived. They didn't leap off the cliff. I was really glad about for that, and so we're driving down the mountain, and in my mind, I'm like, this was a very successful trip. This is a great story. They're going to remember this. They're going to remember the walking in the deep, dark woods and the waterfall and the incredible views. And we get about 5 minutes down the mountain. I don't know if you've been to Caesar's Head. You should go. But the trip up is feels a little bit treacherous. And so I'm driving in my little tiny Honda with my three children. And we get about 5 minutes down the mountain. I'm just focused on staying on the road. And my sweet, sweet daughter, Maddie, who's very brave and in the back seat, she says, Daddy, I think I see a mouse. And I'm like, you mean like running alongside the road? She's like, no, like in the car. And I was like, that's funny. Like, they've been watching these prank TV shows, and I'm like, this is a prank. This is funny. No, Maddie, like, do you see a real mouse? And she's like, yeah, I think I do. I think. I'm like, think is a very important word at this point. Like, do you see a mouse? And she's like, oh, no, I see it. There's its whiskers. And then August, my goober son, who's seven, also in the back seat, says, no, I see his cute little brownie-wownie eyes. And I'm like, oh, that's not good. To which my 9-year-old, Emma, she does what I want to do, and she screams, like at the top of her lungs, like her legs are in her chest, and I'm driving down a mountain. We're an hour and a half away from home, and I'm like, I don't know what to do at this point. And so I find this church parking lot because God saves, and we pull in to the parking lot, and so I get out of the car. My kids get out of the car. We're trying to find this thing, and because I have kids, like the floor of my car is just covered. Like, I have no idea where this thing is, so I'm pulling stuff out, and I can't find this mouse. And I'm like, this is not the story I thought I was going to be living today. And so we have people from the church, like, driving by. Are y'all okay? We're fine. There's a mouse. Well, just be glad it's not a snake. Well, thank you. Now, why does anyone come up here? And so one of my daughters is like, yeah, Dad, I may have left cheese on the ground in the car. This is Emma, the one that's losing her mind. She's like, I may have left cheese on the car and the door open at one point. Thanks. Well, this is a lesson learned. And we can't get I don't even see the mouse. So we make it to TR. And Emma and Maddie switch. And Emma says, Daddy, I see the mouse. And I'm like, okay, all right, where is it? She's like, it's on the back of the chair in front of me. Emma, how high exactly is this mouse on the back? And she's like, it's climbing. It's about halfway up the chair. And I'm like, nope. This is not, mice aren't supposed to climb chairs. They're supposed to be. And so it was the most terrifying. I've driven in some pretty bad conditions. This was terrifying because I was in sandals. Like, it was just not good. And my kids, they were great. Emma, I ended up calling down because I was like, we just need to name the mouse, Emma. We need to humanize this mouse a little bit. And so we called the mouse Daily. So if you see Emma, ask her how Daily is. We found out what happened to Daily because I got into my car a couple weeks later and it smells really bad. It smells so Daily, I don't think Daily made it. I tried. All that to say, sometimes you find yourself in the middle of the story. I mostly just wanted to tell that story. I told Manny I would tell that story. Also, as we step into the book of Esther, Esther is one of those books where I had in my mind when we started this, as we're starting the series, I was very excited, and they said, you're going to be teaching chapter one, and I'm like, this is really great, and then I forgot what chapter one's really about. So I don't know if you've ever started a story, and you're like, I don't remember, I didn't expect that to be like that. I kind of expected Esther to be like this really sweet love story between a princess and a king, and like, I don't know, they've made movies about this book where it's very romantic, and like, this book's not that. This book is very different. And so as we get to, and as we open up the book of Esther, the teacher in me, and I'm just going to preface this, this book is a strange, weird, unexpected book. And as you're turning there, the teacher in me, we left off in the book of Ruth. And there's a couple things that have happened for us to get from, in the history of Israel, from Ruth to Esther. We're just jumping straight from Ruth to Esther. There's a couple things that are going on. So here we go. This is your quick crash course, and I made a little chart in case you're a visual person. And if you're like, the visual doesn't help, that's fine. Just ignore the visual. Just listen to me talk. So in the book of Ruth, what's going on is it's the time period of Judges where everyone's doing like, it's like blood because it's just really bad. It's a bad time to be an Israelite. And God uses Ruth and Naomi to bring about alongside Boaz, they have these, it ends with this beautiful glimmer of hope in the midst of a really tragic story. And we saw that God is providential and God is good to bring about not just the care for Ruth and Naomi, but also for the entire nation of Israel, because Ruth and Boaz are going to have a child named Obed, and Obed's not very famous, but they're going to have a child. Obed's going to have a son named Jesse, and Jesse's going to have a son named David. And through David, we're going to get to the point where Israel is pulled out from this just chaos, this moral chaos and this political chaos. And David is going to be God's mechanism by which, as a man after God's own heart, God's going to create this nation that is phenomenal. Like David, the descendant of Ruth, just crushes everyone. He wipes the floor and they build this nation. And then his son, Solomon, becomes king. And like under him, Israel is truly a great nation. Like all these promises that God made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob from the very beginning of Genesis 12, they're now coming into fulfillment in its fullest. So you have this nation that has arrived. You have these two incredible kings where you're like, this is really great. And then Solomon does really dumb things on the backside of his reign. And God looks at Solomon and he says, listen, I've appeared to you two different times, and because you have rejected me and you have not followed me as your father David has, I'm going to rip the kingdom from you. And it's going to be really bad. So it does. The nation of Israel ends up breaking up into two different nations. It is Israel in the north, Judah in the south, and they're just quick path downward. And over a period of about 211 years in the north, they're wiped out. Like, they're just really, none of the kings follow God. They're all really, really bad. They're all doing, like, when I say really bad, it's not like they found little golden statues of Buddha and they're, like, leaving money at its footsteps. It's like, no, like, child sacrifice, selling your kids into prostitution. Like, these are, like, horrible, horrible, immoral pagan gods that these people are serving. And Judah eventually also, they look at what Israel's doing and they're like, we think, God, you're great, but we're going to do that too. And God's like, if you do this, really bad things are going to happen to you. Like, I'm going to take you into a captivity. Like, I'm going to remove you from the land and I'm going to put you under the rule of pagan kings. And it's going to be like, it's going to be horrible. And Judah's like, yeah, cool. No, we're going to do that anyway. And so they do. And the nation is utterly dismantled until it's taken into captivity by this nation called Babylon. Babylon's really, really bad. Bunch of really bad guys. They devastate the nation of Judah. And then Babylon gets wiped out. Like, so Babylon is, if you remember the story of Daniel, like that's kind of that transition. And then even in Daniel's lifetime, Babylon itself is judged by God. And the nation of Persia is on the rise. So now you have the Jews who started off in the land that God had promised them with Ruth and David and Solomon. And now they are scattered to the winds under the rule of this pagan empire called Persia. And we're introduced to this new king, this king of Persia, Ahasuerus. And so if Ahasuerus is really tough to say, it's easier and it's also probably more in your memory banks to go by the name Xerxes. That's the Greek pronunciation of Ahasuerus. It's the same guy. So that gets us up to Esther chapter 1. A couple of things, even as we get started on Esther chapter 1, because this is the question that the book is posing, all right? And especially chapter 1, for this people, for the Jews who have this sordid past of rebelling against God, there is a question that is constantly being grappled with, both by the prophets and in the book of Esther, and it's this question. As God's people, how are we to live in the midst of corrupt systems and powers when God seems utterly absent? Because Judah, they didn't have representation. They had no one in power. And there's this question, as God's people that have a long track record of failing God, how are we to live as an oppressed people when the culture and the leadership seems bent against the things of God and bent against actually caring for the people of God? And I don't, especially when God seems utterly absent. This is the other strange thing about the book of Esther. The book of Esther, God is, it's the only narrative in Scripture where God is not mentioned. That's weird. There's more weird things about the book of Esther. The book of Esther is actually it's read every year out loud at the Feast of Purim, the Jewish Feast of Purim. And it's this huge communal feast for the Jews. And you're like, that's cool, I like feasts. All right, well, this feast is different. And by different, I mean, it's like that you take this strange combination, and if you ever get invited to go to the Feast of Purim with a Jewish friend, like, you should. It's interesting. It's like you take Halloween, where everyone dresses up, and you're like, okay, that's cool, and Easter, where everyone, like, gives each other gift baskets of candy to their friends and family, and you're like, all right, that's cool, and St. Patrick's Day, where it is considered culturally appropriate to drink a little bit too much. And you're like, that's just very weird. Like, you take all of these holidays, and then you have all of this going on. So everyone shows up to the Jewish synagogue, and they're dressed up. This is just so strange. They dress up. They have their gift baskets they're giving everyone. People are, they've been celebrating Purim. And then they all gather together in their synagogue, and then they read it out loud, the whole book in its entirety. And it's this corporate thing where, like, whenever the villain is named, like, everyone is yelling out loud. This is what we would do if we were celebrating Purim, is whenever the villain's name is mentioned, everyone tries to drown out the reader with screams and jeers, and like, oh, no, he's the bad guy. And then whenever the good hero is mentioned, people, like, cheer and celebrate, and they bring these noisemakers, and you're like, this is weak. Like, this is a strange book. Yes. Again, it's like a mouse in the car. You start off reading this book, and you're like, I expected just a sweet love story between a princess and a king. You're like, nope, that's not. This is a strange book. But God is doing something in this book, because in that culture, it was oppressive to the Jews. And the other last strange thing is this book is a story about the threat of genocide. So you have threat of genocide. God's not in this book. And the Jews are really into celebrating this story. Why? It just seems jarring. Well, that's where we're jumping into. So here we go. All of that. Esther chapter 1, verse 1. Here we go. Now in the days of Ahasuerus, Xerxes, when Ahasuerus had reigned from India to Ethiopia. All right, so modern day Iran to Africa, right? So this guy's kingdom is massive. At this time, it's the largest empire in the known world. In those days, King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, and in the third year of his reign, so he's been king for 3 years, he gave a feast for all of his officials and servants. Now, feasting is going to be a repeated theme throughout the scope of the book. They love their feasts. The army of the Persia and the Medes and the nobles and the governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed them the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. You did read that correctly, by the way. If you're like, wait. So this king, he's been king for 3 years, and he decides, this is what we're going to do with our budget for the year. We're going to throw a feast for 180 days. We're going to gather all of our military officials. We're going to gather all the congressmen and the bureaucrats and everyone together, and all the government officials. We're going to pull them all together, and we're going to have great conversations on policy. Nope. We are going to enact laws for the good of our people. Nope. We're just going to party for 6 months. And you're like, that? Why? What's going on? Okay, well, what historians tell us, and this lines up with what historians tell us, is Xerxes was actually planning a military campaign to a little country called Greece, and where it would not go very well for Xerxes. But before this campaign, what he is doing, and we actually have like records of what Xerxes is trying to do, he's trying to drum up support for the war. He's like, we want to go kill the Greeks, and this is why you should trust me to do it, because I'm gonna throw this really massive party. And you're like, cool. Seems like a good use of government tax dollars. Exactly. All right. And when these days were completed, verse 5, when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting. Because we haven't feasted enough, apparently, lasting for 7 days in the court of the gardens of the king's palace. So he throws this feast for the entire, for all of his officials, and then he's like, for the city, all right, now everyone, I want you to come into the king's court. There were verse 6, there were white cotton curtains and violet hangings, fastened from rods of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, also couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry marble, mother of pearl and precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king, and the drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. So literally, this is all about everyone is drinking a lot. Like, to the point where the only rule was no one's going to tell you to stop for 7 days after 6 months. And the king had given orders to all the staff to do as each man desired. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women of the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. All right, what is going on? Okay, do you think, as you read this, like we think, okay, no matter what side you're on, we can all acknowledge as Americans, like our government's not imperfect. We have an imperfect government. Okay. Yes. Our government, though, is not. Can you imagine what the news would do if the news network said, all right, so our current president, they decided in order to drum up support for a war, they're going to throw a six-month feast for all the government officials, and that's literally their only goal for the next half a year, is they're just going to throw a big party for all of Congress, 6 months. And then they're going to get them very drunk in the last 7 days. This is the great plan. This is our agenda. And you're like, this is the actual government of a great empire. And you're like, this government is a mess. And you're supposed to think that, right? You're supposed to, as we read this, you're supposed to look over, as we're looking over the shoulders of the Jews, you're like, all right, so this great, great empire that you've lost to, apparently, for 6 months out of the year, the only thing they're interested in is throwing the, basically, an oversized pep rally. And you're like, yeah. And for us, as Americans, it is easy to, like, we live in this, and we live under government, and we know, like, well, if the government doesn't do what we want, we just don't vote for them next time. And that's, like, our card. And we know that as our government officials, like, we can write our congressmen, and we're like, well, that may have varying degrees of success. Yeah, but you still feel like you get a voice, right? Like, nod your heads, like, government officials, like, we may not like it, but we still have a voice, still a democracy. If you were a Jew living under the empire of the Persians, you would be reading this, and you are completely disenfranchised. And that's tough for us to sit in. There is this government that is utterly dysfunctional. and the Jews have no recourse. You're not starting a rebellion against the Persians. Like, they are the major military force in the world, and there is nothing you can do about it, and the king has no interest in your good, and the officials have no interest in your good. They are literally only interested in throwing a big party for themselves and for their buddies. That's all they're spending their money on. That's all they're spending their time on. That's all they're spending their resources on, and there's nothing you can do about it. And just sit there. That would be profoundly frustrating. And then you add this other layer, and God seems completely absent. That would be very frustrating. You have to submit to an authority structure and a system of power that is utterly corrupt and utterly self-serving without even the semblance of caring for people, and there's nothing you can do. Cool. So the structure of the government, the nation itself, profoundly corrupt. Yep. Gets worse, though. Cool. Verse 10. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, no kidding, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, I don't recommend these names, Carcass, definitely don't recommend Carcass as a name, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. Okay, and you're like, why is this a big deal? The way this reads, most commentators, they say what King Xerxes is actually commanding his wife to do is he's saying, I want my wife to come out before all of the government officials and all of the bureaucrats and all of the administrators of my government wearing only her crown. So that way you could see how awesome I am because she's my wife. And this is where, like, this whole love story, like, sweet Xerxes and sweet Esther, like, Esther is sweet, yes. Xerxes is the worst. Like, this story does not paint Xerxes in a great light at all. Xerxes is a horrible human being. This guy's a jerk. He's vile. And he is looking at his wife, and he's like, literally, your purpose. She has been feasting on her own for 6 months. He hasn't really seen her. We have no record that he sees her. And he's like, all right, wait, I miss my wife. And also, I want everyone to see my wife. And she looks at him and she's like, yeah, I'm not gonna do that. Because she's sane. And Xerxes now is in trouble. Because this is what he's been doing, if you've been tracking. He's been spending 6 months to build up, like, I'm this really great king, you should all go to war with me. And then he has a seven-day feast, I'm really, really great, you should all go to war with me. And then he's like, my wife is really, really great, come look at my... And his wife doesn't even listen to him. And Xerxes loses face. He loses reputation. He's like, and this is where the story falls into the absurd. Because this is the king of the most powerful empire. Verse 13. The king said to his wise men, let's start at verse 12. Queen Vashti refused to come in at the king's demand delivered by the eunuchs, and the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. Again, Xerxes, you're a mess. Then the king said to the wise men, this is where it gets absurd, said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure to all who were in the law of judgment, the men sat next to him being, another list of guys, Karshina, Shethar, Admantha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcena, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and the Media, who saw the king's face and sat first in the kingdom. So this is like all the main guys. This is the king's inner cabinet meeting. The king says, I told my king queen to do this. She's not doing it. What should I do? And this is where you're like, all right, so king, you are such a failure as a husband, and you're so insecure as a husband, you are losing your mind that your queen rejected this imbecilic, vile request. And so you've gathered your council together, and he says, according to the law, verse 15, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she has not performed the command of King Ahasuerus delivered by the eunuchs. And then Memucan said in the presence of the king and the officials, not only against the king has the queen Vashti done this wrong, and you're like, you guys are morons, but also she has done wrong against all of the officials, what? And all of the people who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. You're like, that doesn't make any sense. Verse 17, for the queen's behavior was made known to all women, causing them to all look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be bound to be brought before him, but she did not come. This very day, king, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard the queen's behavior will all say the same thing to all of their officials, and there will be contempt and wrath and plenty. Are you getting the insanity of this conversation? You have a horrible king giving a horrible command to a queen, and because she's not listening, all of the officials now, you could see all of these guys are gathered together like, man, because the Queen Vashti says no, like there's going to be a rebellion. Like all of our wives, they're just going to ignore us now. Like they're all going to hate us, all of us. Like we need our wives to obey to us, and we have the potential, Xerxes, for a empire-wide revolt of the wives against the male patriarchy. And you're like, this is insane. That these guys, this is the conversation that they're having. Yes, it's intended for us to read this as this government and these men, and Xerxes in particular, are utterly dysfunctional. Yep. Verse 19. If it pleases the king, let a royal order go out from him, and let it be written in the laws and the Persians and Medes, so that it may not be repealed, that this is a reasonable response, king. Vashti's never to come again before King Ahasuerus, and let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. And so when the decree was made by the king, proclaimed throughout all the kingdom, for it is vast, all women will give honor to their husbands, high and low alike. Then we will solve the crisis of our nation, guys. We're going to protect all of the marriages in our empire by exiling Queen Vashti. This advice pleased the king, of course it did, and the princes, of course it did. And the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent letters to all the royal provinces, to every province in its own script, to every people in its own language, that every man be master of his own household and speak according to the language of his people. Guys, thus ends the reading of God's word. All right, what do we do? Like, I'm reading this on Monday. I was feeling terrible before it. I was reading this on Monday, and I'm like, what in the world? Like, I really just wanted to talk about a sweet love story, and this is what you give me, guys. Thanks so much. What is God doing? And what is he telling his people? I think it's helpful, as you pull back the scope of chapter 1, this chapter is really broken up into two parts. The first part, verses 1 through 9, is highlighting the systemic brokenness and corruption within the systems of government that Israel was placed under. Like, you just feel it. You're like, there is no way this empire is going to fix any problems of significance. Correct. You're supposed to feel that. And then secondly, we're intended to feel just utter despair that this king in particular, the individual that the people would look at to save them, is also vile and profoundly incompetent on a scale that is just unheard of. Like, this guy is a failure. Yeah. We have a king who views his wife as a trophy in the most dehumanizing way. And you have this agreement that the best response is to exile his wife and issue a royal edict in the case that all women of the empire get this crazy idea they don't have to listen to every whim of their husbands. And you're like, this guy's a failure as a man. Yes. This is the big thing. Esther reminds us that the world in which the Jews were exiled and that they resided in was utterly and deeply broken and under the authority of one who is also utterly and deeply broken. The systems and individuals that were in place had zero regard for God. They had zero regard for the good of other human beings. Zero regard for justice. Zero regard for righteousness. Zero regard for love. And you're like, great. And it's in this context that the Jews are about to face the threat of genocide. So these, all of the people and all of the systems that we would put into place and that we would expect to save us when we are threatened and when we are in danger and we are at risk, they are all just untrustworthy, to say the least. This is the introduction to the book of Esther. And still, and this is the plot twist, all right, ready? So if you've missed me and you're like, man, this nation is a big mess, what does that have to do with me? It's in this context where you have this no reason to trust the king, no reason to trust the empire. It's in this context you're going to face the threat of genocide, of utter annihilation. That's what's coming for the Jews. And still, the Jews read this story with joy and feasting every year. Like, just hold that together. Horrible system, horrible government, threat of absolute annihilation, and the Jews read this with feasting and joy as they come together as a people. They read it as a point of celebration every year. And you're like, why? There's nothing to celebrate here. If you finish chapter one and you're like, there is nothing to celebrate here, correct. That means you got it. Why is this a celebration? Because in spite of all this, there is hope and confidence that the God who is unseen in these pages will be faithful to deliver and preserve his people. Wait, so do you have that sense? Like, I'm not saying there's a one-to-one correlation. There's not. There's not a one-to-one correlation between Persia and America. Can we just nod our heads? All right. Like, America's, we have our problems. We don't have these problems. God, who is absent from the pages and whose name is absent on the pages of chapter one through the end of the book, was absolutely present, and he will be present to preserve his people. The hope of Israel, the hope of the Jews, was not going to be the systems of power. The hope of the Jews was not going to be a person of power. That's not why they were feasting. It is beautiful. Like, I look at this and I'm like, I get why the Jews read this and remind themselves of this truth every single year. Because we forget. Because the enemy and the world is very quick to sell us three lies. The world is quick to sell us a lot of lies. There's three lies in particular as I was reading this where I'm like, this is relevant for our world and for my heart this morning. The first lie that the world tries to sell us is that my deliverance, my well-being, my happiness, my peace, my joy is dependent on my track record and me being worthy of God saving me. Right? Like, we have that in our minds. That lie gets told to us. Well, I am in trouble, and I did mess up, and I am failure, and so I don't know if God's really going to be here. Do you remember the history of the Jews up to this point? Like, how they got to this point in the first place? They're a mess. They're not better than Xerxes. And God is still present. Like, he still is going to show up in Esther. Like, you had a bad week, you went back to the addiction, you stressed, you raised your voice at the kids, at the spouse, and the enemy wants to sell you the lie that, listen, you've got to fix this or you're going to be out. If you are a child of God, the beautiful echo of this story, time and time again, is that God's presence and care and power is not contingent on your track record. The second lie that the enemy wants you to believe is that your well-being, your peace, the good of your future is dependent on the governing powers of this world. Like, every 24-hour news channel is selling you that lie, by the way. They have no interest
and inflaming the passions of anger and frustration and fear. They have no interest in inflaming those passions and being like, but that's all right, God's got it. It's going to be okay. They just want to keep you scared. Like, if you, like, and I say this from love, like, if this is how, if we were sitting down for coffee and I were to say, this is when I'm going to be concerned for your heart, is if you find yourself watching the 24-hour news channel or scrolling through the news feed and you get done at the end of the evening and you find your heart rate, like your heart palpitations are going and you find yourself just tense and you're like, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, America's all going to fall to pieces. I need to like rise up because don't tread on me. And you're just like, we're going to lose our mind. At that point, in love, I want to look at you and be like, Esther's going to be good for you. Because of all of the things that we have in America to feel frustrated about, like, they had them in spades, and God delivered his people. He took care of them. The call to Esther is not a call. Just rise up and lose your minds. It's a call to rest with joy. Awareness of what's going on in the world? Yep, absolutely. Is this a call to ignorance? Nope. But it is a call to rest because we have a good king. We have a really good king. The third lie, that your well-being, peace, and future is going to be dependent on a single individual, be it your spouse, be it that child, be it the employer, caring for you and treating you as they ought to. Because Xerxes is going to show up and be a husband at some point in this story, which is just gut-wrenching for Esther. Like, it's not, we're not happy. Like, we're not supposed to be thrilled for her. It's actually really sad. Forcefully taken from her, this is a spoiler, she's forcefully taken from her home and forced to sleep with this guy. And then forced to marry him. And you're just like, this is sad. And the happiness and the peace and the joy of this people is not contingent on Xerxes as a human being. And some of us, and I've been here, I've lived in going to bed at night, my peace and my happiness being contingent on whether or not my kids are doing what I think they should be doing, or my parents are doing what I think they should be doing, my boss is doing, not Jason, he's great. But you get what I'm saying, when I lived out in the world of schools, man, administrators are really something sometimes. And it's easy for our peace in that moment and our joy to be contingent on them doing the things that I want. And this is the beautiful truth of this story. It's not. God's people were going to be fine even though significant people in their lives had no interest in doing what God wanted. And God was still present and preserving for his people. I want you, like, if you just take a moment and be like, this person in my life right now, they're a mess and I can't fix them. No, you probably can't. Xerxes doesn't get fixed in this book. You are going to be cared for. You will be cared for. That's the promise. And like, how do we navigate this? To live in the midst of the world with all the turmoil and forces that feel like they're actively working against the kingdom of Jesus, right? Like, and there's some people who just live in this constant state. My brothers and sisters live in this constant state of just fear, angst, bitterness, rage, fighting the culture war. And I don't see that here in this story. But how are we to live as God's people in this? I was reminded this week as I was meditating on this, one of the first shows I ever got to be part of. That would become one of my favorites, is the story of Fiddler on the Roof. I don't know if you've ever seen Fiddler on the Roof. It's very long, so strap yourself in, but it is this beautiful story of what it was for the Jews to live in the middle of Russia when the rising tide of culture was just against them. And there's this question in Fiddler on the Roof, like, one, where is God? How are we to be his people and operating in a world where everyone is just pushing against us? And the resounding metaphor that they keep coming back to is that Tevye, the main character, he keeps coming back to is, we are like fiddlers on a roof. We are scratching out a joyful noise from a position in this world that everyone around us is looking at and saying, what are you doing up there? Why are you prancing about on a roof with a fiddle? You're like, this is what it is to be the people of God. And you're like, how can we do that? Because God is present there. In your place, in the things that you are going through, where the rest of the world can look at and be like, that is a mess, and there's no one that's caring for you, and you are in a position of great danger, and I don't see what God's doing, and that might be the echo in your heart. God is present, and he is sovereign. He has you in his hand. And it is from that place that we get to create a beautiful melody before a watching and broken world. I want to invite the band up. David, and he was running from his son, Absalom. His life was threatened and everything seemed to be falling apart. This was David's words. In Psalm 2, he says, why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. And then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury. As for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. I will tell of the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me and I'll make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them to pieces like the potter's vessel. And he concludes with this, amidst of all the turmoil. Now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear. Rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. But blessed are all who take refuge in him. Let's pray. Lord, this world seems to thrive on fear and outrage. It is so easy to give ourselves to it. But you have called and you have promised that as your kids, we get to live with joy and confidence because you are King. I pray for my brothers and sisters, Lord, like I ask that as they go about in this world with systems and powers and people that are just bent on rebelling against you, Lord, that we would be a people who get to feast with joy no matter what's in the news, because you are with us. You're good and you're powerful to save. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for joining us for this week's message. Summit Upstate's mission is to give every man, woman, and child repeated opportunities to see, hear, and respond to the gospel. For more information about Summit Upstate and other available resources, check out our website at summitupstate.org.